Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, May 30th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. Today's episode of Talk Nerdy is sponsored by Reasonist Inc., your one-stop shop for super cool atheist and science apparel and accessories. Go to ReasonistInc.com today and enter promo code TALKNERDY for 10% off your order. That's ReasonistInc.com. Guys, I'm really excited about this week's episode, but before we jump into it, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week, including Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Charles Payet, Jafe, The Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. If you would like to support the show, just visit patreon.com/talknerdy, and you can sign up to be a patron. All right, guys, this week I chat with the host of The Rubin Report. Here he is for the second time on the show, Dave Rubin. Dave, thank you so much for joining me today.
Kara, it's always a pleasure. And if the people knew the technical stuff we had to do to make today happen, oh my God, we'd win some kind of award.
We probably should anyway, I think, especially because we are two people that live almost in the same city but need to record remotely.
Yeah, we have our reasons that we can't be together on this day. There are specific reasons that I don't want to get
into.
Which
is totally fair. And so what we're doing now is we are following up. We did an episode of Talk Nerdy way back when. Honestly, I don't even know when you were on. It was like,
I think it was June of 1986.
I was 3 years old. No, I'd only been 2 years old. Yeah, it was a while back. You were like one of my earlier guests. So I'm really pumped to be able to revisit our conversations. And I think we talked a lot about Golden Girls.
We probably did. Yeah, that was at the beginning of Talk Nerdy for you. And it was sort of, I think, right at the beginning of when I started my show at Aura. So we were both sort of in new gigs.
Yeah.
And things have worked pretty much, knock on wood, for both of us. So we'll
see. I know. We've been really lucky. And I'm really excited about all of the changes that you've made, kind of having your YouTube channel, which used to be at the Young Turks, was independent. And now you're doing this great kind of video interview series at Aura TV. Why don't you tell people who are listening who might not have seen it what the kind of idea is of the Rubin Report?
Yeah, so I was with the Young Turks for about 2 years, and they're sort of far left progressives, and that's kind of where my politics were for a long time. But I sort of evolved differently and moved over very shortly. For about 2-3 months, I was with Riot, ryot.org there. They were then shifting into like 3D video and stuff and virtual reality. So it wasn't quite the right fit, although I loved everyone over there. And then I jumped on to Aura, which is Larry King's digital network. And he started it with Carlos Slim, who is pretty much the richest man in the world, although that is not reflected in my paycheck. But Larry King's over there, and Jesse Ventura and William Shatner had a show, and a couple other people. And we were planning on doing the same kind of show I was doing at the Young Turks, which was pretty much kind of a Hot Topics on The View, a mix of politics and pop culture and, you know, newsworthy buzz kind of stuff. And then my first episode was with Sam Harris, who I know you know, and I'm sure many of your audience kind of loves and admires.
Sure.
And I just love doing the one-on-one thing with him, just that real connection to one person, sort of like we're doing right now, and really hashing out ideas and talking about controversial topics and really bouncing things back and forth. And from that, I continue doing the one-on-one thing. You were actually on the second episode, and I've said on my show many times, I bring you on to clean up all my scientific messes. And that really just spurred on just really everything else that I've done, which now it seems to be working. People are kind of getting that, you know, the message of my show, which is we have to not be afraid to talk about controversial ideas. We have to not be willing to demonize everyone who thinks differently. Mm-hmm. We have to not be afraid to talk about certain ideas because they're politically incorrect. I mean, this is stuff that we should all know, but for some reason has really been lost in 2016.
It really has, especially with the crazy political climate that is going on right now. I mean, have you had anybody on your show recently that's like a hardcore Trump supporter or anybody from that side of the aisle?
Yeah, you know, I've really been trying. You know, everyone talks about the echo chamber mentality, and we're all doing it these days worse and worse, right? If you are on Twitter, if you don't follow people you disagree with, you're doing yourself a disservice because you're only having your ideas reinforced all the time. I follow people all over the political map, the spiritual map. I follow believers and non-believers, and I follow Republicans and Democrats and anarchists and libertarians and God knows what, right? And you have to do that because otherwise, if you just hear the same things that you believe all the time, you will become exactly what you should hate as a free thinker, right? And so, yes, I've had Milo Yiannopoulos is probably the most well-known one. He's a huge Trump supporter, and I'm actually going to speak with him at UCLA tomorrow night. And he was just at DePaul University and had college kids coming up on stage and grabbing the mic and protesting him and all kinds of crazy stuff. And this is the stuff that's happening on college campuses more and more. They're so afraid with all this trigger warning stuff, all this safe space stuff, all this deplatforming of authors and speakers, that you become coddled to the point where if anyone says anything that you don't agree with, you think that's hate speech. Yeah. And that's so crazy, and it's so dangerous, and that's why we have to stop it from taking root in the colleges, because we're setting up these poor kids for a real rude awakening when they get to the real world.
It's especially dangerous, and some would argue unconstitutional, when it's happening on the campuses of public universities, universities that are funded by federal money, because especially, you know, all the First Amendment rules really go out the window when you start talking about private entities and when you start talking about, you know, I own my own organization or I own my own TV show or I own my own university. And so I can make some rules that maybe the general public wouldn't agree with. But if we're talking about protected speech specifically on a public platform, that is what a college university is about, especially if it's a city school, a state school, a school that receives federal funding, is it not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, you as an interviewer don't have to invite every single person onto your show, right? That has nothing to do with free speech. You're making a choice to say, this is the type of person I want to talk to. This is the type of person whose ideas I want to amplify. Or maybe this is the type of person whose ideas I want to expose to be ridiculous, right? But that's not what free speech is. The problem is that when you look, free speech, the First Amendment, and people still, even smart people get this confused. The First Amendment is about the government coming for your free speech. So you're already making that distinction when you talk about public funding versus a private school, right? But I don't even fear anymore that the government is coming for anyone's free speech. You know, you could talk about, you know, everything that's going on with Snowden and the NSA. That's not really about speech. That's about state secrets.
Yeah, espionage. They're using the Espionage Act there.
Right. So whether that's right or wrong, and I tend to veer on the side of him that the government was doing some bad stuff, but that's not specifically about speech. So in most cases, you can say whatever you want about the United States government. And if anything, people will think you're cool and you're fighting the power and you're a real badass, right? But it's not about that, the threat to free speech. Right now, what it's about is that the more that we call everyone we disagree with a racist or a bigot or a homophobe or the made-up term Islamophobe, the more we're taking free speech away from ourselves. These kids that need trigger warnings and safe spaces to hear ideas that might scare them, they're taking away. College is where you're supposed to be exposed to bad ideas. What do they think is going to happen after? And I sound like an old man when I'm saying that, these kids at colleges, but like, you know, I'm not that old yet, but, you know, they have to get used to this now. And that's why I've been talking about it so much, because it is truly, truly a danger. And then, by the way, when you don't talk about scary ideas, so let's take, you know, if you were to talk about some of the stuff that Trump has said with Islam, right? Now, he doesn't barely make the distinction between Islam, which is a doctrine, a set of ideas, versus Muslims, who are people who may not believe in those and may just like tradition, versus some that are jihadists and all kinds of stuff, right? But if the left, and this is what I've been saying on the show all the time, and this is what Ayaan Hirsi Ali talks about in Majid Nawaz and Sam, of course, if the left is afraid to talk about ideas honestly, it makes it very easy for someone like Trump to come in and say something ridiculous like ban all Muslims, and then good people, good, decent people feel like they have to turn to him because he's the only one expressing anything that is close to what they're thinking, even though they're not really bigots. So that's the dangerous part of if we're afraid to exchange ideas. We just open up the door for terrible people to walk right through.
Yeah, for these polarizing ideas. I mean, we saw a really great example of this. Gosh, how long ago was it now that Ben Affleck was on Real Time? And he was just... really, I don't know what it is, if it's a party line, if it's, you know, trying to just keep reinforcing what the echo chamber has communicated to us, but he sounded like a broken record. And it was, there was just no nuance in the conversation. There was no ability to even, I don't know, to even assume or question whether or not ISIS, for example, has anything to do with traditional Islam.
Right. Well, this is like every time that ISIS blows up something or a jihadist group blows up something. Take the Paris attacks at the theater, you know, a couple months back. I see a lot of my friends on the left immediately blame Western foreign policy. Now, I don't think Western foreign policy has nothing to do with why people are angry at the West. We've done some bad things. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, ISIS then releases statements saying we're doing this in the name of religion. So we can't be afraid of that idea. But, you know, I actually thank Ben Affleck at this point for what happened that night on Real Time, because that was my awakening. Yeah. I remember watching that. I think I've told you this, that I was watching that. I didn't even really know who Sam Harris was. I don't think I was following him on Twitter or anything. And I saw this guy and he went up there and he quoted some Pew polls and he said, you know, there are nominal Muslims, there are Islamists who are part of political Islam, there are jihadists who believe in violence, et cetera, et cetera. And then Ben Affleck threw out that ridiculous canard of gross and racist. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly the onus was on Sam and Bill Maher to prove that they weren't racists. Yeah. Bill Maher, who has stood for every liberal principle for as long, he's further left than I am. So that's the danger of it, that what you do is then you take people who are good, decent people, Bill and Sam, who had some controversial ideas, because it's tough to talk about this stuff, and suddenly you make them the enemy, but they're not the enemy. And by making them the enemy, you create this space for then Donald Trump to walk in. So these things are very much linked. There's no doubt about it.
So how scared are you of Donald Trump?
Oh, man. You know, it's such a mess. Our political system is such a mess, which is one of the reasons that I'm really looking forward to going to the Reason Rally with you in a couple of days.
What a good plug.
Yeah. How is that? How is that to bring it around? Well, I really am, because, you know, I spend so much time in this political space. And, you know, I say to people now, I used to be funny. I don't know if I'm funny anymore, but there was a time in my life that I was a very good comic. And I had a good 12 years where I was a funny person. And now it's like I'm talking about jihadism and I'm talking about religion and all this stuff.
It has its moments. It's quite humorous, the topic.
It does have its moments. That's true. But look, the country is in a really bad place, you know. Are these two candidates, assuming that Bernie drops out, which I know his most ardent supporters don't believe in math, but he's pretty much going to have to drop out.
It's a tough position. I mean, regardless whether it's Bernie or Hillary, it's a tough, tough road ahead, because Trump has a lot of support. He has a surprising amount of support.
You know, right now, he has either the most votes that a Republican has ever had in the primaries, or he's about to crack it and absolutely will blow it out of the water by the time California is done. So think about that. I mean, that's pretty powerful. Now, look, I get it. That's just a segment of the Republican Party that can vote in these primaries, right? But it shows you something. There is something happening here. And actually, it's totally linked to what we've been talking about already, which is this stuff about free speech and about political correctness. He gets up there and he says anything, and he contradicts what he says the day before, and he says something terrible about Rosie O'Donnell or about Megyn Kelly or this or that, or about mentally handicapped people or whatever. And it's like people are so tired of feeling that they can't express anything, that they hear him say this and they think he's a hero.
Yeah,
for
it's like refreshing to them.
Yes, and so even though I disagree with him on probably everything in principle and probably everything in terms of how I want the government to work and what I want the president to represent and all that. I do understand why people are voting for him. And again, this is why I want the left to be better, because if they won't be, then they're going to hand it to these guys, whether it's Trump or somebody else in the future. Yeah. We need better dialogue. And that's why I try to do an interview show that's about dialogue.
And that has nuance in it, you know, that's not so polarizing. That's not so, maybe not even polarizing is the right word, but so binary. I feel like we're so stuck with these false dichotomies when we talk about
Absolutely.
These complicated issues. Of course, there's gray area in every complicated issue. And we're just being intellectually lazy lately. It's so nice to be able to have long form conversations where you can dive into the nuance. I have a quick random aside question that I feel like I've been hearing a lot in, you know, you keep up with politics, I think, probably much better than I do. I try, but it's an interest, but it's not really, I think, a professional forte of mine.
You're probably healthier mentally, so it's
exactly.
All right.
Exactly. So do you think that right now, obviously, the race is not very tight between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. It's everybody who is looking at the numbers, as you said, is pretty confident at this point that Hillary is going to take the majority of the delegates and she will end up being the Democratic nominee. Do you think that the fear, or I shouldn't say the fear, but that the individuals, the diehard Bernie individuals who are so anti-Hillary because they're so anti-establishment politics may mm-hmm. actually go to the right because Bernie will likely not get the nomination?
Yeah, I do. I think there's going to be a shocking amount of them that vote for Trump just because they want to blow up the system at this point. And that's been my issue, really, with the way a lot of the Bernie supporters have been. And I don't mean Bernie himself. I've said this a couple of times. I actually like Bernie, the person, more than I like the way a lot of his supporters are behaving. Because a lot of his supporters, I'm talking about the mainstream ones, have painted Hillary to be this evil, warmongering, neocon, blah, blah, blah. Now, look, she did vote for the Iraq War. Now, a lot of people did, including Joe Biden, who's the vice president right now. But, you know, they were lied to also by the Bush administration, particularly Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. Mm-hmm. So, but she did vote for it, for sure. But you know what? She basically, there's no reason to think she would govern any differently than, pretty much any differently than Barack Obama for the last 7 years. So most people don't think Obama's a warmonger. Now, ironically, he's been the longest serving president ever at war because we've been at war his entire administration. And I'm pretty sure if we had drone strikes happening over our heads, we wouldn't be happy with it, which is going on in Afghanistan right now. And we're back in Iraq and we're doing stuff in Syria.
But it's true. That doesn't seem to be his legacy, even though, if you just change your perspective, obviously you could say as a president, he has been a warmonger. But many people don't see Barack Obama as his legacy.
No, they don't. And look, I don't think that should be his legacy because I think he has done a lot of good things.
Yeah, and you could argue that he inherited all of this in a lot of ways.
Sure. You know, the inheritance argument like that, we could have like a 10-hour conversation on that because at some point it is on you.
That's
right?
True.
At some point. And look, you know, Iraq, when George W. Bush was still in office, Iraq was having real elections. It was turning around. Now, Obama had the troops withdrawn. It was something that was signed by the Bush administration. But if we had wanted to stay and help mitigate some of the in-between time, we probably could, and maybe it wouldn't be this big of a mess. But of course, this is all, you know, hindsight, whatever. Yeah. But to your question, the people that have painted Hillary as this evil monster, I think are really doing a disservice to democracy because certainly to the party. If they just believe that they're Democrats, then they've done disservice because they are going to end up sending a lot of those people to Trump. And look, if your goal is just to burn the system down and just to blow up the system and change everything, then sure, then go for it. And, you know, that's your prerogative.
But there's a difference, I think, between a structured revolution and pure anarchy. And I do fear, you know, I know some Bernie supporters that are really diehard that I guess are less concerned about Hillary as a hawk, like, you know, as a quote unquote warmonger, and are more concerned about her as a very establishment, especially like anti-environmental candidate. I know a lot of people mm-hmm. who really have a hard time with her association with big oil, which is not unique. It's just not what they want to represent the Democratic Party. So individuals that are more like environmental voters have a hard time with her. And also individuals that I think are more their single issue is about campaign finance reform. Obviously, I think that they see Bernie as a better example. I don't think Trump is going to fucking do anything about campaign finance reform. And I think that if the oil industry said to Trump, here, let us help fund your campaign, he would say, fuck yeah. Like, it's not it's not that Trump is equal on in that aspect. Just because he's an outsider doesn't mean that he is going to not become exactly what Hillary Clinton is.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. You never know. They all say anything to get elected.
So true.
That they simply all do. People really need to understand that. You know, when Obama was running, he kept saying, when we do healthcare, Obamacare, we're going to have all open door meetings and we're going to put it all on C-SPAN and you'll be able to watch all of that. Well, then we know that obviously not only did that not happen for 1 second, but there were all kinds of shady deals made with senators who were retiring mm-hmm. and all kinds of crazy stuff, right? Obama has prosecuted more reporters than any other president. So they all will do anything to become president. And yes, look, Bernie, when it comes to the money and politics thing, obviously is the best. But at the same time, at some point when the math becomes inevitable, you have to start cutting your losses.
It's like Nader. It's just like Nader. I mean, I think a lot of us were really, really excited about Ralph Nader and about some of the ideals that he really stood for. But at a certain point, when you realize they don't have a chance...
Right. Well, look, it's, you know, right now I feel very much, I would consider myself, I at one point I was a progressive. I would say I've always been liberal. Mm-hmm. I remember being in eighth grade I guess it was 1992 or 88, I think, when H.W. Bush was running against Michael Dukakis. And I remember they were mocking Dukakis because he was a liberal.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, how crazy is that? Like, liberals are the good guys. Liberals care about minorities and care about women and care about gays and all that stuff. And there's very little space for a true liberal that cares about freedom of thought and free thinking and all that on the left right now because of the reasons that we've already laid out. So this, when it comes to, like, you know, can you vote for Bernie now or even if he's going to lose or the people that voted for Nader and all that, you know, at some point, I would say if there's ever been a point where maybe you do an election on principle, maybe this is it, which is a little bit reverse of what I've been saying about Bernie, because we need more parties at this point. You know what I mean? More than anything else.
Yes.
Maybe the biggest thing Bernie will give us is that at the end of this, you know, the Republican Party is basically split in two right now between the real conservatives and the Trump people. And maybe the Democrats need to do that too. And maybe in 4 years, we'll have a couple other parties, which I think would be much healthier than what we have now.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if the Tea Party gave us anything, if crazy Donald Trump gave us anything, and he's not even a Tea Party candidate, but like in some ways he might as well be. In other ways, like, I still have no fucking idea what he stands for. But
he's a big government Democrat. That's
yeah,
the thing.
That's the crazy thing. And there's a handful of times when he says things where I'm like, holy fuck, I agree with Donald Trump. And it makes me feel really dirty on the inside. But if they gave us anything, it's that the right, at least right now, is splintering. And you see this growing group of more moderate Republicans, more traditional Republicans that are like fed up with being, I think, associated with the Tea Party and the far right and wanting to reestablish what it means to be an establishment Republican. I think Mitt Romney is a good example of that. And if we could see that kind of change happening on the left, in the opposite, a pulling
Absolutely.
Away from establishment, the establishment Democrats, yeah. and a formation of a more left-wing version of the Democratic Party.
Carrie, you know my favorite phrase on Twitter is this hashtag regressive left, and I've been saying for months if the actual real liberals who are for... truly for equality, truly for taking in information and analyzing it and then making decisions on that, if those classic liberals don't stop this regressive part of the left now, then the left will split. Now, I think it's actually happened already. Mm-hmm. I think the split is here and now. But, you know, you hit on something earlier about this fear that we have of nuance and to debate ideas and things like that. And I remember when I had you on my show in September, mm-hmm. One of the things I asked you about was abortion, and we sort of went back and forth for about 10 minutes. And that's like one of the topics where people go completely bananas,
yeah.
where if you're on the right, you say that everyone on the left hates babies. And if you're on the left, you say that everyone on the right hates women. And it's like, that's just not true. That's not true. And it's silly. And it's like, we should be able to have an honest discussion about, you know, I'm pro-choice, but I can understand why someone would say, you know what, at 7 months, at that point, that is a living being in there, and that having an abortion is murder. But then does the government have a role to play in taking care of that child if you're going to force the person to have the child? Like, we have to not be afraid of those very complex issues, and that's what we're completely afraid
of. Yeah, it's, you know, there is a big difference, I think, between personal, I would say, moral and ethical viewpoints and taking those viewpoints and spreading them across an entire society. I do think, you know, when I was young, I don't know if it means I was more liberal or if it just means I was more cynical when I was young, but I had a real problem with legislating morality. And I think it was maybe my rebellion as a young atheist against Christian privilege in this country and against the things that I knew about how legislation has often been dominated by Christian privilege. And I remember writing a philosophy paper in early college about seatbelt legislation and how I had a really hard time with seatbelt legislation because it took choice away from individuals. Mm-hmm. As I've gotten older, I've started to understand, or I've started to evolve my own viewpoints in such a way that I think that the only point of legislation is morality, and that the reason that we have laws is to protect individuals and to make ethical choices, really hard moral and ethical choices about how a society should be run in a healthy way and about how individual liberty should be protected. And those are moral decisions and things.
Wow, Kara, that's a very libertarian
point
of view.
It is very libertarian. Well, yeah. I'm a fucking horrible liberal, right? Because I'm like, I'm pro GMO, you know? It's like I confuse everybody. but
a true liberal, a classic liberal and a libertarian are basically the same thing. And you just hit it right there. That really is that what you're asking is what's the role of the government? And that's really the question that we're afraid to talk about.
It really is in so many ways. And I think the problem comes in when we start talking about where we get our morals. And I think as an atheist, the assumption that morality cannot exist without religious influence is an assumption that I'm always trying to push through. That being said, I know plenty of people, plenty of evolved religious people who personally, for example, disagree with abortion and would never have one, but understand that as a society and in order to protect individual liberties, we have to allow abortion for people who don't believe the same things that you believe.
Kara, think how crazy it would be if you're an atheist,
of
right?
Of course.
Now, have you ever murdered anyone?
I have not yet murdered anyone.
Okay, not yet. But what are you basing that on? Why aren't you
murdering
someone?
Oh, I see. Exactly. Is it the Bible, or is it because I don't personally think, I have an intrinsic viewpoint that it's not my right to take away the life of another individual?
Right. So you've used information as a human being on this earth to deduce that murdering other people is a bad thing. It's not only bad for them, but it would probably be bad for you. If you were only basing that on what the Bible said or some other book, I mean, that's really crazy. You're actually taking away the most intrinsically human thing about us, which is our ability to reason. Mm-hmm. So that's the scary part. And that's what people have to understand. If you can't be moral without religion, you might have some other stuff that you need to work through.
Seriously. And this crazy assumption, I guess people who live underneath a religious bubble for so long, who don't either never had life without religion or don't remember life without religion. Let's say they were born into the faith that they continue to be in to this day, or they converted so young that they don't remember their own kind of moral viewpoints prior to that conversion. The bizarre belief that somehow not having a religious conviction bankrupts you of any personal reason or agency is a very difficult conversation to have. And it's a very difficult bridge to cross with those individuals because it's so fundamental to almost everything that is built upon it.
Yeah, well, it's funny that we give people a certain amount of credit for taking the leap of faith when it comes to this. I mean, look, if you were to take every other instance in your life, you do things based on evidence. You know what I mean? You cook when you're cooking. Mm-hmm. You don't just guess. You don't just take a leap of faith that the egg is going to cook exactly how you want it. You have to learn how to cook an egg properly. I probably could have used a better example
no,
than an egg. A little
it's
more,
good. It's
a
simple.
Little more intricate. Yeah, it was simple. Okay, there you go. So why would you not use the same amount of reasoning for the biggest question of humanity, for the biggest question of the universe, which is what are we doing here? Why do you get credit for saying, well, I've just decided to believe in something? That's not something you should get credit for. Now, look, I don't care. I know some atheists, and I've had David Silverman on, who I know you know from American mm-hmm. Atheists. I had him on the show a couple weeks ago, and Paul Prevenza, who's also an atheist. And, you know, David is much more, I think, anti-religion than I am. My personal belief is you can believe in whatever you want. And as long as you don't push your beliefs on someone or try to behead the non-believer, then that's up to you. I don't need to tell you how to live your life. I'm just living my life the way I want to live it. That's really as simple mm-hmm. as that. But we shouldn't give credit to people who've just decided to make something up. And that's really what people are doing. And that's okay if you want to do it, as long as you're not harming anybody.
And the problem is it's built in within the structure of religion. We often talk about religion as if it's just something that passively happened. Like all things being equal, religion just forms. No, this is an active right. path that individuals, oftentimes individuals with a strong megalomaniacal bent, individuals who are utilizing it in terms of, you know, there's been many, many situations where religion and government are inextricably linked, especially historically, but even to this day. Religion has often been used as a means for either providing some sense of stability or social control in a culture. So this idea that these things just happen is, I think, really naive. This is these types of legislative decisions that have been made. These are specific choices that have been made by individuals with a goal in mind. It's agenda driven. And so just like you were saying, this idea of I'm just going to take a leap of faith and I'm going to be almost like applauded for that. The gross thing is that is central to the way that many of these religions were built. It's part
Absolutely.
Of the dogma that just reinforces it.
Absolutely. And that's why defending atheists in all of these closed societies is basically the most important thing you can do. In all of these places where women are treated horribly and gays are treated horribly mm-hmm. and other religious minorities are treated horribly, you know, not that I'm here to defend religion, but when the people who practice
sure.
it are treated horribly, not the ideas of it, but the people who practice it peacefully are treated terribly, we have to stand up for atheists wherever they are. Because guess what? Any society, I'm pretty sure I can say this empirically, any society that treats their atheists well, guess what? They're pretty much the ones that treat all their minorities well. Not perfectly. We've got problems here. We have problems with religion, and we have racial problems and wealth, income disparity mm-hmm. problems and all that stuff. But if you treat your atheists well in any society, you've already started to do something good.
Yeah, and we don't.
It doesn't mean you have to destroy religion altogether if some people need it. But if you treat these people well, you're saying, I'm a society that is okay with some free thought. And that's how you expand what being a human is all about.
Exactly. And I think that's why it's so important that in America that we be the leaders of this movement. And we don't have a good track record of it. Now, granted, it's not the same as it is in Saudi. I would never compare us to Saudi. Obviously,
right.
their civil rights abuses are, you know, leaps and bounds beyond ours. So that said, we don't have the best track record for, I think, maybe we have legal protections in place for atheists, the same as we would hope that we do, but we don't have a good track record for, you know, openly atheist individuals having any chance of getting elected. We don't have a good track record of having legislation in place that doesn't have sort of a tinge of religious preference. Like we have a...
Well, look at Bernie. I mean, look at Bernie. I would guess that if you really got him to say what he truly believes, I'm pretty sure he's an atheist, because every time they ask him about religion, he says, well, I believe that humans are all connected
yeah.
and treat the... Like he's just giving you some standard old
stuff. But the
problem
is he's not allowed to say he's an atheist, because if he does, then he won't get elected.
Right. And it also brings up all, you know, people love saying that, you know, he's the first Jew that's ever won some primaries and blah, blah, blah. And then if you were to say, well, he's a Jew and an atheist, that brings up a whole other conversation about ethnicity and religion and identity and all that stuff. So it would be so confusing. So I think we're a couple years away from getting to that conversation.
But I think you're right. I think you're right. This idea of kind of respecting religious freedom in a culture has so many parallels with a civil rights movement, with women's mm-hmm. suffrage, with all of these different movements, that it's almost like if the atheist movement had happened prior to a lot of these other big civil rights changes, obviously the civil rights movement being probably the most powerful and the most in many ways sad, the movement in our cultural history that really had the most violence and the most just death and destruction associated with it, but following in the footsteps of the African American civil rights movement, the women's suffrage movement, the LGBTQ rights movement. If the atheist movement had happened prior to all of those things, it may have actually paved a way for those things to change more quickly. It's almost strange that it's kind of the last big civil liberties push that we're seeing in this culture, because all of those other things are linked to the idea that if you choose not to be a believer, that your morals don't have to be founded in that.
Yeah, well, you know what? You're right, because it's the great equalizer. Mm-hmm. Because if you were Black, obviously you personally have a vested interest in the equality of Black people. And as a white person, you should also, but you know, it's more personal.
Yeah, as a white person, you should, but that doesn't mean that you necessarily will, unfortunately.
Right. And that's the thing. When it comes to atheists come in every one of those categories you just mentioned: women's rights, Black rights, LGBT rights, all of those things. Guess what? They're a gay atheist. They're a Black atheist. They're a women atheist. Mm-hmm. They're a trans atheist.
They're a Black, et cetera, et cetera. Trans atheist.
They're a Black, trans, queer, yeah. Quaker atheists. I mean, yeah, you could think of every version of it. And that's the point. And that's why it's such an important, actually an important movement, and why I've compared it often to that atheists need to come out more. I still see on Twitter all the time that the bulk of atheists that tweet at me all day long, they're avatars or cartoons, and it's not their real names.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are in Western societies. I would suspect that most of them are in America that are tweeting at me. Now, I get it. If you're an atheist in Egypt, maybe you don't want to, but actually I just had an atheist in Egypt on my show a couple weeks ago. So it's changing, but it's the great equalizer. Just saying, I'm going to believe in what's empirically provable. I'm going to treat the biggest questions, as I said earlier, the biggest questions with the same scrutiny that I would treat any other issue. Mm-hmm. That transcends borders, and it transcends religion, and it transcends everything else, color and everything else there is. So there's something so powerful here, and that's why it's so important for us to find these people wherever they are and help them be who they are,
yeah.
Because that's what will erase some of this stuff that's actually bigoted and prejudicial.
It's true. It's fundamental to these bigoted and prejudicial viewpoints throughout the world. It's very easy to forget that many of the problems with women's rights, many of the problems with ethnic rights, or, you know, equality amongst different ethnicities, amongst different social groups, the rights of LGBTQ individuals, those things are fundamentally rooted in religion. It's very hard to find an individual or an organization that says that they, you know, don't think that gay individuals should be able to adopt, or don't think that gay people should be able to be open about it without going to prison. I don't think I could put my finger on a single organization or individual who is in many ways anti-LGBTQ that's not also religious. Those things are inextricably linked. And you see it also with historical patriarchal societies. You see it with the oppression of women. It's very heavily linked with this white male dominant religious, especially Judeo-Christian culture. But actually, I shouldn't even say especially, because you also see it in Eastern religions as well.
Sure. And look, as Bill Maher says, you know, when you put all these restrictions on people, and, you know, if being gay is not okay and you're gay, or if seeing a woman that's not in a burqa, you never get to see that.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? That's fertile ground for terrorism. It's fertile ground to make people believe in crazy things, because they can't get their normal human emotional needs out in a sensible way. So then they turn. So if you can't have premarital sex, or if you're gay and you can't have sex or whatever it is, well, then 72 virgins in heaven sounds pretty fucking good.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. That's where we have to disconnect these things. And you know what? Most of these murder, whatever they are, when people go shoot everybody up, and, you know, so I'm talking about domestic terrorism, yeah, or Islamic terrorism or whatever it is, there's a mental component to it too. But a lot of that is couched in the way religion has made people think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question, this idea of, is religion the excuse for the in-group, out-group, tribalist, sectarian views that would persist regardless of whether or not religion was around? Or is religion the cause of those kinds of viewpoints? And a lot of times, I think when you argue with individuals about religion, it comes down, as you strip away the layers, you come down to that fundamental argument. But I would venture to say that it doesn't really matter whether the sectarianism and the mm-hmm. and the tribalism came first or the religion came first, because they're so linked together now that just trying to suppress either of those viewpoints, trying to allow alternative viewpoints to flourish against both of those things, is helpful for society to evolve and to become open.
Absolutely. And that's why you have to let good ideas flourish. And that's why I couch this all around free speech, because the only way we're going to beat these bad ideas is beat them with good ideas. You know, I'm Jewish. Even though I'm not a believer, I'm culturally and ethnically Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I remember being at Temple when I was a kid, and, you know, every holiday was, well, we didn't all get killed this time, you know, Passover, we didn't all get killed in Egypt and Purim. Well, the Greeks didn't kill all of us, or Hanukkah, that was the Greeks, I think, or this one, the Romans, and that one, the other one. And we didn't always all get killed. And then at the same time, we're thanking God constantly. Thank God we didn't all die this time. And thank God, again, he didn't kill everybody. This guy's fantastic. Like, that's kind of bonkers. So for me, but yet the culture around Judaism, which is very much about comedy and certain foods and thinking a certain way and education and science. I mean, so many great scientists are Jewish and all that kind of stuff. All of that I have a great affinity towards, and it's very much part of my life. So that's the other part of when you attack religion so vociferously, mm-hmm. you turn people away that you might be able to turn to our side, because they go, wait a minute, my mom was a believer or had these traditions and she wasn't so bad, or my grandma
or she was a pillar of the community and she was the best person I knew.
Exactly. And that's what we have to be careful of. So I don't, you know, I've had a guy, Ali Rizvi, on my show. He has a book that's coming out, I think in about a month, called The Muslim Atheist, mm-hmm. or The Atheist Muslim. And he basically couches exactly what I just said, but from the Muslim perspective, which is, he's a complete non-believer. He believes in science and rationality and free thinking, but he likes some of the traditions and the holidays, and he should be entitled to have an ethnic identity based around that, because that's what his family had. So in my view, we have to be a little more tolerant of that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I also understand why people just want to eradicate it altogether.
Yeah, but I mean, goodness gracious, that was a nuanced conversation about religion.
Hot damn,
I'm so taken aback. Well, hey, I want to take a quick minute to thank my sponsor of this week's episode. But when we come back, Dave, I'm really interested to talk about your journey into atheism, but also about this hot topic, which is the regressive left. You guys, I am so excited to be partnering with the awesome folks at Reasonist Inc. this week on Talk Nerdy. They have a really cool online store filled with fun stuff for only the most discerning thinker like yourself. There are science t-shirts, really funny atheist tees, hoodies, jewelry, signs, and posters, and lots of other accessories for all you godless heathens. And honestly, wearing these shirts really does start the conversation and get people asking questions about what it means to live a secular life. My two favorites, which I wear all the time, are this cute black t-shirt that says, "I only date atheists," that always catches attention, and a really bright red t-shirt that says, "God is the square root of -1. Get it? Square root of -1? God is imaginary. A for math jokes. Anyway, I don't know what you're waiting for. You should visit ReasonistInc.com today because as a special Talk Nerdy listener, you get 10% off when you use the promo code Talk Nerdy. So don't wait. Go now. That's ReasonistInc.com and use the promo code Talk Nerdy, all one word, for 10% off. Once again, that's ReasonistInc.com. Okay, so we are back with Dave Rubin of The Rubin Report. And Dave, you know, you mentioned the Reason Rally earlier. We are both going to be speaking at the Reason Rally. That is this weekend, the specific day of the rally. There's so many good programs around it. I forget which is the specific. I think it's Saturday,
right? I believe
right?
It is Saturday. The big event is Saturday. Yeah. And then there's going to be a little convention on Sunday with some smaller talks and things like that.
Yeah, June 4th, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. It's at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., and it's free and open to the public. Now, I didn't go 4 years ago at the first ever Reason Rally. This is the second ever Reason Rally. And I guess from what I gather, this is just a great big gathering of individual secular thinkers, whether they're atheists, you know, humanists, free thinkers, however they want to describe themselves. Basically, just individual who support the separation of church and state, individual who think that you don't require God in order to be a good moral person, and individuals who think that public policy should be evidence-based, just like all of the things that we were talking about earlier. If you're one of those people, you should come to the Reason Rally on June 4th and join us, because apparently last time there were like 30,000 people there. It's a huge gathering of like-minded people, which is pretty cool. So you're coming.
Yeah.
I'm going to be there. A bunch of other great speakers like Margaret Cho and Kelly Carlin and Bill Nye and James Randi and a lot of really cool people, Carolyn Porco. Do you know what you're going to talk about yet?
I don't know exactly what I'm going to talk about. You know, I have some general ideas and it's probably some of what we've already been talking about here. But I'm looking forward to just being around people that care about this stuff. Because, you know, I spend too much of my day seeing what's going on Twitter and watching CNN and checking out the news. And we're so, everything about our dialogue in this country has been dumbed down to the point that, yeah, we're left with this Donald Trump option. And it seems rational to people. It seems acceptable and okay. And the idea, everything that you just said, describing the Reason Rally, people that want evidence-based policy, things like that, that's just, all we're asking is that we live by the laws of the land, that we write laws based on factual things, that we look at evidence and say this is the best way to build a road system, or that climate change is real because of this or that, or whatever else it is, that we look at things from real provable ways. And then we say, now how do we make a better world, a better country and a better world? And we so don't do that normally. So I'm just looking forward to being around the people. And I think the inspiration will just sort of, it'll just pop, because it's going to be very refreshing to have my brain actually expanded instead of stunted.
Absolutely. And this is coming from two people, guys, who live on the West Coast. I mean, we live in Los Angeles, where there are a lot of enlightened individuals, also a lot of like woo-woo, crazy, you know, anti-science individuals. But for those of you who are living in pockets and regions in the Bible Belt or in the Midwest, where you don't even know other like-minded individuals, you've never even met other atheistic thinkers or people who are overt and open about being atheist, this is such a great opportunity to come and meet people who, you know, have those same viewpoints and rally together and try to put pressure on your representatives in Congress. There's a whole program where you can go to the Hill and you can try and make sure that your voice is heard. These kinds of things are just so incredibly important. So I know that, Dave, we were texting or maybe talking offline one day, and you had mentioned to me, you know, prior to coming to the Reason Rally, that I always just kind of knew you were an atheist, or just kind of assumed you were an atheist, but I'm not sure I ever actually heard you use the word atheist on air. When did you first come out and actually use that term, atheist?
I mean, believe it or not, it's only about 6 months ago, and I'm 39 right now. I'm going to be 40 next month. And, you know, when I was doing my show at TYT that you were a frequent guest on, a lot of the times that I would have you on, I'd purposely try to find an atheist story, because I always thought these things were interesting. And I had two or three other atheists that were my go-tos, but you were always my number one. And and you still are, whether you like it or not, you still are my number one atheist. But I always, it seemed to be the default position to me. So I never really thought about it in that, oh, this is so specifically how I think per se. It just seemed, as I said earlier, that I would base the biggest questions in the world the same way I would base any other question in the world. And I would have shows about atheism, and I always considered myself, you know, people say I'm a friend or an ally of the LGBT community. That's sort of how I viewed myself. Like, oh, I know a lot of atheists. I like atheists. I very, very rarely hear atheists say anything prejudicial or bigoted. They seem to base their thoughts on the same things that I base my thoughts on. So I never really thought about it. And then I had you on the show, as I said before, it was the second episode at Aura. And then about a month later, I had Milo Yiannopoulos on, who's the Trump guy that I mentioned. And we started, and he really is against atheists. He thinks they're all whiners and babies and blah, blah, blah. And we got into it. And it was really the first time that I ever flat out said it on air because I felt on the defensive suddenly. And then I was like, all right, well, I have to sort of make a real statement here on the way I view the world. And I said it, and it doesn't change anything. It doesn't change anything. And believe me, if tomorrow Moses showed up and he split the ocean at Santa Monica Harbor, I could reevaluate. But until then, you know, if
it's interesting. Yeah, it's like, and it's funny because it doesn't change anything for you personally, for the person who says the words. It can, obviously, we know, if you're living in a closed society, even if you're living here in America, I always try to make sure that I make this point. If you're living, you know, deep in the Bible Belt and it's unsafe for you to come out and you'll be putting yourself at risk, nobody has that expectation of you. If anything, we have the expectation of individuals who are in a position of the freedom and the relative safety to be able to do that so that your future will be brighter and so that your children will be able to come out if this is their thought process and their viewpoint. So it's interesting to say for you, like it doesn't change anything of your beliefs, obviously. You still think the same way. It's just a label. But what it does change so much is the fans that you have, the individuals that have been following your show. When they hear somebody that they look up to or somebody who they agree with quite often saying those words, it can help cement in them, oh my God, like this is what's happening for me too. And it's so meaningful to see somebody who I really look up to using that label as well. It makes it that much easier for me to do it. It's so silly that something, it's a fucking label, but it can be so freeing.
Well, it's freeing, and you're totally right. And there were a few people online, just Twitter people, who were really outspoken atheists, not even necessarily public people, just people that tweet about atheism a lot that I don't even know who they are in reality. But I was like, these people are saying things that I like. They're saying things that I agree with. So I am a public person. So I have to say something about this. But, you know, real quick to what you just said about the Bible Belt, which you're obviously 100% right. But we shouldn't forget that it's not this isn't just an issue of Christianity in America, because there are plenty of Orthodox Jews in Brooklyn who, if they came out as an atheist, would be kicked out of their families. And there are plenty of Muslim families who, if their son came out as an atheist, you know, then they're apostates. And according to Islam, they can actually be killed. So these are real things. And I know most of what we, because Christianity is sort of more the dominant power in America, we focus on that. But there's plenty of other problems there, too.
So true. And that's, you know, it's funny that it just is a little window into this cognitive bias that we often have, which is we really do golden rule the world. We see the world through our own lens. And of course, being raised as a Mormon in Texas in the Bible Belt, that is the religious kind of oppression that I see the world through. And yes, it is kind of the dominant majority religion, not Mormonism by any stretch, but Christianity.
But you know what, you as a Mormon, it's a really interesting thing because, you know, we do have this, and I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the regressive left, but we have this pecking order of who you can make fun of and how you can make fun of them. Mormons are very high on the list of people you can make fun of, right?
They're like with Scientologists and Jehovah's
Witnesses. So you can mock the hell out of Mormonism, say whatever you want about Mormonism, and everyone on the left We'll cheer you for it the entire time. Yep. We'll tell it's so funny, ha ha. They believe in who's the guy, John Smith and Joseph Smith.
Yeah,
right, Joseph Smith, whatever. And you can do a play on it on Broadway, and John Stewart can say it's the greatest play ever, and whatever. Yep. And then there's other religions that you can't say a word about, and if you do, even if you quote pupils, as we alluded to earlier with Sam Harris, now you're a bigot and you're racist, even though a religion is just a set of ideas. There is literally no difference of this. There is that Mormonism is a set of ideas, Judaism is a set of ideas, mm-hmm. Christianity and Islam. These are set of ideas based on old books that people came up with. But for
some of them newer than others, but yes,
sure.
You're right.
And by the way, that doesn't mean they're all equal in terms of one could be worse than the other. You know what I mean? For example, if the average Jewish person was to leave Judaism tomorrow, no Jew would care. Most Jews would be like, oh, good for you. You know, nobody would care. You still like bagels? Great.
Yeah.
But now that doesn't mean there are some ultra-Orthodox people who would care. Of course, no one's saying all. And that's what makes this conversation so difficult, because every time you say something, people are like, oh, you said all of them.
Then you get emails.
Right. And then your email box blows up, or your Twitter mentions, whatever. But the fact is, that does tell you a difference, that what can we talk about and joke about, and what can't we? And that's why there's so much backlash from this regressive left about Islam, because that's the one that they hold in the highest regard. Now, ironically, it's the one that is the most regressive right now in 2016. The places where Islam is are the most regressive places in terms of women's rights and gay rights and minority rights and all of that stuff. That's just a...
Especially the places where Islam is a state religion.
There are 51.
There are some predominantly Islamic countries where there's a better division between church and state, where we don't see the same issues. But places that are predominantly Islamic, where, like, for example, Sharia law is rule of law, like where religious legislation is in place across the board, these are the most regressive places in the world.
Absolutely. And that's why, as free thinkers and as secularists, and especially as atheists, you have to be willing to talk about this. So every time someone, and you know, Sam Harris has been the poster boy of this, every time he opens his mouth and uses the same standard of evidence on Islam that he would use on every other religion. You know, he's written a lot more about Christianity, actually, than he has about Islam. He wrote a letter to a Christian nation. Guess what religion it was about? Mm-hmm. you know, but nobody cared about that, because you can go on Saturday Night Live every week and mock Christianity, just the way you can mock Mormonism and all that, right? And that's all fine.
And that shows progress. Yes. The fact that you can mock these things shows that they are abundant in a progressive society.
That's the point. And by the way, Kara, that's why the cartoon stuff is so absurd. Listen, if you believe that in your religion that no, you as a person, as a believer, can't draw that cartoon, well then don't draw it. But if you say, if someone else, a non-believer, draws this cartoon, I'm going to kill them or hunt them down or make their life otherwise miserable. Well, what else should we then concede to religion? Because that's what happened. Remember, after Charlie Hebdo, I had a lot of my friends on the left, and this is where my awakening really started. It was around the real-time thing, but it was also this. I had a lot of my friends on the left saying, well, you know what? They just shouldn't do that. They just shouldn't do that. And once you give ground, once you give an inch, you're already saying we've lost. Because guess what? The same people who don't want you to draw Muhammad, they're not okay with gay marriage. So should we not have gay bars then? With that, we don't want to upset them. You know, should we not should women not wear bikinis because, you know, they'd rather them in burqas? And that's the flaw of this regressive ideology. It's such a huge flaw. In the name of tolerance, they actually become incredibly intolerant of the minorities within minorities, of the people who are the most important to help. And once I had the awakening about that, everything else becomes pretty crystal clear.
So I have a question for you about the regressive left, which I often struggle with, right? Because I've been like... I've been accused on Twitter before of being a member of the regressive left, or I've been accused of being, what do they always call you? And they see it as an insult, like
a social justice warrior.
Warrior. Yeah. And so, and to me, it's crazy, because I think in many ways, across the board, the conversation that we've been having about the regressive left right now is a conversation that I often have. I don't use the terminology, mm-hmm. like the hot button terminology that I think really gets people excited and gets people saying, oh, you're one of me versus you're mm-hmm. not one of me. We're in the same group. I don't use the term regressive left very often, but First Amendment protections are incredibly important for me. I am a huge advocate of rethinking your viewpoint on what's PC, what's not PC. That said, as you are a gay man, I am a woman. And so obviously some of our policy decisions and our choices are informed by our own struggles,
absolutely.
Right? Black individuals spearheaded the fucking civil right. rights movement. You are a huge advocate of LGBTQ rights. I, of course, have to advocate for rights
it's
for women.
It's called self-preservation. There's
woman.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And we try our best when we do exist on the left to help try and ensure that the rights of minorities are protected and the rights of certain organizations or classes that have been historically disenfranchised are brought to the surface so that we can have reasonable conversations about them. And what bothers me, I think, about the movement, and it's not about the ideology behind mm-hmm. the regressive left skewers. You know, it's not about the people who want to bring us our attention to the foreground about the regressive left. It's the co-opting of the movement by misogynists. And I see a huge conflation of these Gamergate, anti-social mm-hmm. justice warrior, kind of pro-men's rights activists that utilize the argumentation about the regressive left as a platform to kind of inflate their anti-feminist
sure.
ideals.
So,
and I'm interested in your
yeah,
take
well
on
that,
that.
There's a lot there. And, you know, every mm-hmm. movement that we've talked about, from gay rights to civil rights to everything else, movements change. And the people that are involved in the movements, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. had a very different take on how the civil rights movement should go than Malcolm X. And there were many more militant, so to speak, gay leaders in the 70s versus some that wanted to do things, you know, more quietly and allow for change more quietly. So yes, is there some element of misogyny as part of this group of people who are fighting against the regressive left? Yes, of course there is, because every movement has every kind of person in it. And you know what, I think really to your point, I think it has something to do with that a lot of people have in this movement have found that modern day feminism has become a problem, that not first wave feminism and first and second wave feminism that were really about women's rights and equality and getting the right to vote and equal pay and things of that nature, but what feminism has become, which is more about rape culture that often isn't that existent actually in Western society, or the pay gap, which usually at this point they've proven repeatedly is because women choose different jobs. And a few other examples of that. So then when men talk about that, or these men's rights guys, it makes it sound like suddenly they're anti-woman, when generally they're not. But I totally hear you. And you know, just as far as the phrase itself, regressive left, like, I'm very proud that I had a little something to do with popularizing it. And, you know, mm-hmm. I think this is a rot of the mind on the left, and it needed to be addressed. And that's why I've hit it so hard as I have for these last few months. I've actually been trying to back away from the phrase itself a little bit, because I don't want it to become just a pejorative, like racist, bigot, homophobe, and whatever. I don't want to use it to silence.
As an insult. Yeah. And that's you do start to see the evolution of that happening. Like, I've definitely had individuals on Twitter, if I tweet something about, you know, oppression of women, or if I tweet something about trying to improve the status of like women in STEM careers, I might get like these kind of crazy men's rights activists mm-hmm. coming out and calling me like, well, you're just a member of the regressive left. And it's like, what the fuck are you talking
well, listen,
about?
That,
like,
that would be, that's probably a better example of that Twitter is not all reality, right? Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, people sit on Twitter anonymously all day long and they say things that they would never say to your face in reality. And so you have to couch a little bit of that with just that, right? These are just people sitting at home just, oh, by the way, you put your name out there and your face and your beliefs out there.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a very easy target, as am I, right?
Of course.
So I don't. So we have to get away a little bit of what the Twitter people say. But to that point, I'm sure that I'm guilty of overusing it at some level, or at least as it's changed, that maybe I should be using it a little bit less. It's about the ideology. I'm not trying to make this about individual, you know, you're a regressive, like, you know, because you said one thing that I didn't like, so now you're a regressive. That's just silly. But it's about an ideology that for some reason, all of these good things that we've talked about women's rights and gay rights and free thinking and atheism, the one religious ideology that's the most against it, most actively in 2016, and you know which one I'm talking about, that's the one they defend the most. And that itself is regressive. That is not progressive.
Absolutely. And I 100% agree with you on that point. And I think I would just urge you, as in many ways an architect of this movement, and as somebody who has, I think, a lot of sway when you talk about these things publicly, to really look at the nuance and explore, because I would push back a little and disagree with you a little that maybe we shouldn't minimize the individuals within the movement, whether we want to use the term regressive left or not. We shouldn't minimize the individuals within the movement that are overtly anti-woman. I do see a big kind of trend in this direction. And we shouldn't say, oh, let's not paint it with a broad brush. Of course, we don't want to do that. But we shouldn't also just say, oh, it's one or two squeaky wheels. Let's not worry about them. Because the last thing I would want to see happen is what I actually do kind of see happening, which is that this individual group with a strong ideology that is in spades, like exactly not what you're trying to accomplish, starting to co-opt that.
Yeah, well, look, about a month ago, I heard on Fox News this guy, Greg Gutfeld, say the regressive left. And on one hand, I was like, wow, like this thing's really bubbling up to mainstream. And then at the other point, I was like, oh, God. This is terrible because now it's being co-opted by the right. And that's not what I want either. And, you know, that's part of any movement, any political movement, any ideological movement or philosophical movement. Things change. And of course, look, you're a woman, so you're going to see things that I don't. And I know you and I trust you and I believe you. So I'm sure there's evidence of what you're saying in a way that I just simply don't see it. And that's why it's important having these conversations. So I can be aware of that and you can be aware of it and the listeners can be aware of that.
Yeah, and that's why I think nuance in this situation is so important. I would end with the thought that, I mean, just look at, if you don't know much about the background, dig into it, read about it. I'm not going to soapbox anything, and I'm not going to tell you what my perspective is, although I'm sure you can guess it, and you can look back through any sort of tweets. But if you look at something that happened recently with Nexus in New England, a conference on science and skepticism, which is the organization of the Skeptics Guide to the Universe that I work with, but I am not on their board. The decision that was made around Richard Dawkins speaking following a tweet and blah, 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 and the conflation and the confusion between having this anti-Islamophobia viewpoint mixed in an inextricable way. I've just said that five times so far on the podcast. It's the word of the day, apparently. Mixed in with this anti-feminist, anti-woman viewpoint. It's like when you start to try and tease these things out, it's nuanced and it's complicated. And the individuals who kind of pushed back in a very binary way, who said, this is absolutely wrong and under no circumstances should this ever happen, versus those who say this is absolutely correct and you absolutely did the right thing. I can attest to the fact that when the board was trying to make a decision about this, it was not an easy decision. Yeah. And this is what we see often in politics. This is what we see often in these complicated decision-making positions that, I mean, this is why I think it's so easy for us as citizens to look at our elected officials and go, he fucked us, or he's doing the right thing, or rah, rah, you know, this is how they approach foreign policy, or this is how they're approaching, you know, domestic issues. It's like, it's never that fucking easy.
It's never. And that, but again, that's why. So wait a minute. So you're saying if you vote for Hillary, it doesn't automatically mean you're a warmonger? I can't believe it. Like,
exactly.
But, you know, but real quick on this, on the Islamophobia thing, and then quickly on the Dawkins piece, you know, the phrase Islamophobia, first off, this was a phrase that was coined by the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt.
Of course.
That is not a real word. A phobia is an irrational fear. If you are a free thinker or a gay person or an ex-Muslim, most importantly, or a less of a believer than the perfect standard of Islam, then having a fear of something that would kill you is not phobic. So it's important. You can be bigoted towards Muslims, and that's a problem. But the word Islamophobia is really being used in a really terrible way, and it was designed to spread like that. That's number one. And number two,
Yeah, it's propaganda. Like, first and foremost, the term is propaganda, and the fact that we've utilized it as liberals is really dangerous. Also, half the time, we're not even talking about, quote, phobia. We're talking about intellectual disagreement.
Of course. No one says you're a Christianophobe, right? So we have to remember that. And then just real quick on the Dawkins thing, you know, it was about that YouTube video that most of your listeners probably saw,
Or maybe they didn't, so look it up, because I'm so sorry if we're like being really esoteric.
So basically, it was a video, a cartoon that was really trying to show the way that Islamists and feminists have sort of been in bed together, that often feminists will excuse horrible treatment of women if it's done in the name of Islam, where they would never do it in the name of anything else. Now, I actually, you may disagree, but I agree with that premise. The problem was that apparently the woman in the piece was actually based off a real woman. So when Richard Dawkins tweeted it, yeah, I guess he didn't know that at first. So he wasn't trying to make it about the person. He was trying to make it about the idea, which is something that I think most of us good people on liberals try to do. It's about an idea, not a person. I personally, of course, would not have deplatformed him.
And even beyond that, I think that my biggest take on it was that if you don't know anything about this issue and you're coming at it naively, which the vast majority of people are who click on a tweet, it's not even that apparent when you watch the video that that's what it is indicting. The video does come across as a very anti-feminist video, like a very anti-woman video. If you read about it and you start to understand context and you start to look at it in a much more nuanced way, which is what we're advocating for, then you can start to have these kinds of conversations. Unfortunately, I think that the decision, I cannot speak out of turn for the group, but sometimes the decisions that you make to disinvite a speaker or to not have invited a speaker in the first place, or all of these complicated, difficult decisions that are, and it was handled poorly and there was an apology that was sent and he was ultimately reinvited to talk about these very issues, but then he had a stroke, unfortunately, and wasn't able to come. Maybe he wouldn't have anyway, but the unfortunate thing is that oftentimes what we're left with is decisions made based on reactions. I think for many people with Dawkins, it's less about whether or not you agree with his ideology, and it's more about whether or not you think that he's just really bad at social media and makes really stupid decisions that alienate people. And if you implicitly are, you are kind of implicitly endorsing those kinds of decisions if you invite somebody to be a speaker. Of course, they never should have invited him in the first place if that was a real fear. And as a private organization, like we talked about earlier with First Amendment rights, that's your
choice. Love that you said that. That you said that, because that's what it's about. You have to have your thoughts, not only react to other people. And when I was very much in the progressive politics world, I felt that 90% of the time, it wasn't about what you stood for. It was just about everyone that you hate and everyone that you're against. And that didn't strike me as a particularly enlightened or bright or even effective way of trying to make the world a better place.
That is so insightful. Like, you have to have your own agenda and your own ideals and fight for what you truly believe in. And if you're always freedom fighting against the boogeyman, then your own identity is going to be really splintered and really factioned. And there are situations. I mean, right now is a perfect example. We need to stand up to try. And this is me, you know, this is me soapboxing and this is me proselytizing a little bit, but we need to stand up to squash Donald Trump and to not allow him to win the general election in November, because it will be detrimental to our country, not just domestically, but internationally as well. And so there are times when you have to band together to fight against a common enemy. But in times of peace and in times of thoughtfulness and intellectual flourishing, that's when you have to have your own ideas so that later you can identify who the bad guy
is. Exactly.
And
you know what? If you want to, this can be my closing statement. If you want to beat Trump, if you want to beat Trump, you don't beat him by protesting, blocking roads to his rallies, which people did a couple weeks ago. And you don't beat him by burning cop cars, which they did a couple weeks ago at one of his protests, because that just makes people want to vote for him more, because they go, whoa, the left is out of control. Trump will save us from that. You know how you beat Trump? You beat him with better ideas. You expose all the things that he said every which way. You say this, you know, you attack that he doesn't seem to have a moral center and all of those things. but you don't silence the free speech. Because the believe me, those people that were driving to a Trump rally that day that got stopped on a road, I think it was in Arizona, and couldn't get to the rally, their wherewithal to vote and for support for him was multiplied many times over. It was not squashed. And many people watching it on TV felt the same way. So you always will beat bad ideas with good ideas, not by silencing the ones you don't like.
Absolutely. All right, Dave, that was a great note to end on. And for those who I think were inspired by that note, let them know where they can find your show and where they can find you in social
media. Yeah, my branding guy's good. So it's YouTube. Well, I'm losing my voice at the last second. How did that happen? it's youtube.com/RubinReport, R-U-B-I-N, and I'm Ruben Report on Twitter and facebook.com/RubinReport and Instagram. And I think I'm on Snapchat, but someone else does that one for me. I just can't take it. And find me and you, if you're out at Reason Rally, come find us and say hi, and maybe we'll get a drink or talk life or see what happens.
So much fun. Well, Dave, thank you so much for taking the time. This was a really enlightening conversation, as always.
My pleasure. And I'm going to have to go to D.C. to see you, ironically. We're doing this. We live like 6 miles apart, but I'll see you in D.C.
Yeah, I'll see you in D.C. And everybody listening, thank you so much for joining me week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.